Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo presents Words and Their Stories. Later, we bring you the American History Program, Making of a Nation. But first, this report.
When Grant Cornwell became the 15th president of Rollins College in Winter Park, Florida in 2015, he understood the challenges he would face. He had already served as president of the College of Worcester in Ohio for 8 years. College and university presidents in the United States have many different responsibilities in addition to the daily operations of their school, Cornwell notes. These include identifying the strengths and weaknesses in school operations and creating a plan to improve them. Another duty is communicating the needs and concerns of students, parents, professors, administrators, and governing boards among the different groups. In addition to these responsibilities, there are special issues that current presidents must deal with, says Cornwell. He notes American college students are more diverse than they have ever been, racially, economically, and in other ways. Schools welcome this diversity, but it also means there are far more needs that must be met, such as mental health and educational support. Cornwell argues that every generation of president feels the issues they face are the most difficult. They choose to work in the field, he says, because they believe a strong education system is necessary for a healthy democracy. But it is not an easy job. It takes about a year to listen and learn enough about a place before you should have an opinion about direction, Cornwell told VOA. And then it takes a couple years to really formulate a plan. And then it takes at least 5 years to execute a plan.
However, a new study suggests fewer U.S. college and university presidents are staying in their positions for as long as Cornwell suggests. Experts argue this is because the job is, in fact, more challenging than it ever has been. Every few years, the American Council on Education publishes a study on college and university presidents. In the most recent publication, researchers spoke with presidents at over 1,500 public and private 2- and 4-year institutions about their positions. The study showed that in 2016, the average amount of time presidents had been in their current positions was 6.5 years. In the 2011 publication of the study, the average amount of time presidents had been in their current positions was 7 years. In 2006, the average was 8.5 years. Jonathan Burke is the Associate Director of the Center for Policy Research and Strategy at the American Council of Education. He notes that the researchers only spoke with current presidents. To get a better idea of presidential service lengths, they would have to speak with former presidents too. But Burke says, in general, the last three studies do suggest a decrease in the length of time presidents are serving. Why might this be happening? He blames, in part, changes to the level of state support for higher education.
Burke says that following the economic recession the U.S. faced in 2008, most states greatly reduced their financial support for colleges and universities. Many are only now starting to return to the levels of financial support they offered before the recession. Yet, there have never been as many students entering American higher education as there are now. This means many presidents are expected to do more with less, he says. The amount of pressure that I think is placed on these individuals to be able to perform at such a high level can lead presidents to leave their positions maybe sooner than maybe what we would see 20, 30, 40 years ago, Burke added. Yet it is not just an issue of financial limitations, says Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. After all, state support is mainly for public institutions, she notes. The overall cost of higher education has increased greatly in recent years, Pascarella notes. That is in part due to reductions in state support, but also because of increased government regulations. Schools must employ more administrators to make sure they are following these many new rules, she says. And the needs of a more diverse student body means greater spending on support services.
These increased costs have intensified the debate over the overall cost of receiving a college education, she says. Parents want to know that the money they spend will get their children good jobs afterwards. At the same time, governing boards more often want presidents to run schools like businesses rather than as a public good. They want to have greater control and faster results from improvement plans, reducing the level of shared governance with students and professors. And, Pascarella says, this generation of students are more politically divided than those in the past. Student demonstrations have become common, as have intense exchanges over social media. And disputes over issues like racial inequality, sexual violence, and free speech lead to debates that quickly get out of a president's control. If you have someone knocking on your door saying, "We've just read this in the newspaper," what are you going to do about it? It doesn't give you an opportunity to respond in any thoughtful way, said Pascarella. She and Grant Cornwell agree that presidents leaving their positions sooner can greatly harm the long-term goals of an institution. Avoiding this means schools should be paying presidents more than they have in the past to match the increased risk. But a study published in the Winter 2019 Review of Higher Education argues that increasing presidential pay may not be that helpful to the school itself. The study looked at presidential pay at 119 public institutions. It showed there is no relationship between higher pay and increases in outside donations or state aid, two things for which presidents are often considered responsible. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. Each week, we explain where American English expressions come from and how to use them. Today, we turn once again to the animal world We talk about an animal that has been a great service to humanity, the guinea pig. Guinea pigs are native to South America. Some people say the small, very social creatures got their name from the fact that they make noises like a pig. Another reason, they say, is that guinea pigs first left their homeland on ships that sailed between South America, Guinea, and Britain. Other experts suggest that guinea pigs look like the young of another animal, the guinea hog, also called the river pig. Over the years, guinea pigs have earned our respect. They have, after all, played an important part in keeping people healthy. For two centuries, they have been used for medical research. Their natural defenses against disease are similar to that of human beings. Scientists used guinea pigs in early studies of infectious diseases, such as tuberculosis and diphtheria. Today, they are often used in studies of sexually transmitted and other infectious diseases. Rats are also used for laboratory experiments. But as it turns out, guinea pigs have more in common with people than rats do. So they are a better choice for some studies. These experiments have led to the use of guinea pig in the English language. Some say that the term guinea pig, meaning one subjected to an experiment, was first used in the 1920s. And this expression is still very common today. If someone calls me a guinea pig, it means that new ideas or methods are tested on me. I am part of some kind of experiment, and it does not have to be one in a laboratory. Let's hear this expression used in some examples.
I have some new dishes to serve at my big dinner party, but I've never made them before. What if they don't taste good?
How about if I come over this weekend and you can cook them for me?
Great idea. You can be my guinea pig.
You can call me whatever you want, as long as I get to eat your great cooking.
This milk smells funny. Will you try it and see if it's old?
Ew, no. I'm not your guinea pig. Try it yourself.
The city government is trying out a new recycling program. It is the first of its kind in the nation.
Ugh, not again. Why must our city be a guinea pig for every great idea our politicians hear about? And yes, I said great, with quotes, because they're not great at all.
Yes, I heard your quotation marks.
Good.
The expression guinea pig carries a lot of meaning with only two words. Calling yourself a test subject sounds way too scientific. And we just do not use it that way. A similar term, lab rat, is rarely used, and it does not sound very nice. And saying that you are being experimented on to see if something works is so very long. Guinea pig is much more common, and you can use it in any situation. Well, the only time you may not want to use guinea pig to mean a lab animal is when speaking to someone from PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. They may not like it. Another person who may not like this expression is someone who takes care of one as a pet. That's right. These animals do much more than help in scientific research. In the United States, many people own one or more guinea pigs, much like you would a cat or dog. And that's all the time we have for this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Dr. Heckel is his own little guinea pig, 'cause they all think he's mad. Sets his sights on the search of a lifetime, and he's never, never sad. Whoa, it's off to work he goes, in the name of science and all its worms.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. South Carolina withdrew from the United States on December 20th, 1860. The state seceded because a Republican, Abraham Lincoln, had been elected president. The Republicans were a new party, and Lincoln was the first to be elected president. They wanted to stop slavery from spreading into the Western territories. Southern states believed they had a constitutional right to take property, including slaves, anywhere. They also feared that any interference with slavery would end their way of life. Frank Oliver and Larry West tell what happened after South Carolina left the Union.
South Carolina faced several problems after it seceded. The most serious problem was what to do with property owned by the federal government. There were several United States forts in and around the port of Charleston. Fort Moultrie had fewer than 70 soldiers. Castle Pinckney had only one. And Fort Sumter, which was still being built, had none. The commander of the forts asked for more men. Without them, he said, he could not defend the forts. The army refused. It told the commander to defend the forts as best he could. He was told to do nothing that might cause South Carolina to attack. If South Carolina attacked or planned to attack, then he could move his men into the fort that would be easiest to defend. That would probably be the new one, Fort Sumter.
The governor of South Carolina planned to stop any movement of federal troops. He ordered state soldiers to stop every boat in Charleston Harbor. They were to permit no United States troops to reach Fort Sumter. If any boat carrying troops refused to stop, the state soldiers were to sink it and seize the fort. 6 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, the commander of Charleston's forts decided to move his men to Fort Sumter. They would move as soon as it was dark. The federal troops crossed the port in small boats. The state soldiers did not see them. The governor was furious when he learned what had happened. He demanded that the federal troops leave Fort Sumter. The commander said they would stay. The governor then ordered state soldiers to seize the other two forts in Charleston Harbor. And he ordered the state flag raised over all other federal property in the city.
President James Buchanan, who would leave office in just a few months, was forced to deal with the situation. His cabinet was deeply divided on the issue. The Southerners wanted him to recognize South Carolina and order all federal troops out of Charleston Harbor. The Northerners said he must not give up any federal property or rights. The president agreed to meet with three representatives from South Carolina. They had come to Washington to negotiate the future of federal property in their state. The attorney general said the meeting was a mistake. These gentlemen, he said, claim to be ambassadors of South Carolina. This is foolish. They cannot be ambassadors. They are lawbreakers, traitors, and should be arrested. You cannot negotiate with them.
The Attorney General and the Secretary of State threatened to resign if President Buchanan gave in to South Carolina's demands. The president finally agreed not to give in. He said he would keep federal troops in Charleston Harbor. And he said Fort Sumter would be defended against all hostile action. On the last day of 1860, he ordered 200 troops and extra supplies sent to Fort Sumter. The War Department wanted to keep the operation secret. So the troops and supplies were put on a fast civilian ship instead of a slower warship. It was thought that a civilian ship could get into Charleston Harbor before state forces could act. But a Southern senator learned of the operation. He warned the governor of South Carolina. When the ship arrived in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina soldiers were waiting.
The soldiers lit a cannon and fired a warning shot. The ship refused to stop. Other cannons then opened fire. The commander of federal troops at Fort Sumter had a difficult decision to make. He had received permission to defend the fort if attacked, but his orders said nothing about defending ships. He knew that if he opened fire, the United States and South Carolina would be at war. The decision was made for him. South Carolina's cannons finally hit the ship. The ship slowed, then turned back to sea. It returned north with all the troops and supplies.
The commander of Fort Sumter sent a message to the governor of South Carolina. "Your forces," he wrote, "fired this morning on a civilian ship flying the flag of my government. Since I have not been informed that South Carolina declared war on the United States, I can only believe that this hostile act was done without your knowledge or permission. For this reason, and only this, I did not fire on your guns." If, the commander said, the governor had approved the shelling, it would be an act of war, and he would be forced to close the port of Charleston. No ship would be permitted to enter or leave. The governor's answer came back within hours. He said South Carolina was now independent. He said the attempt by the United States to strengthen its force at Fort Sumter was clearly an act of aggression. And he demanded that the commander surrender.
During the crisis over Fort Sumter, Congress tried to find a compromise that might prevent war. Lawmakers proposed a new line across the country. South of the line, slavery would be permitted. North of the line, slavery would be illegal. Many Republicans supported the proposal, even though the Republican Party opposed the spread of slavery into the Western territories. One Republican, however, rejected the idea completely. He was Abraham Lincoln, who would take office as president in March. Lincoln said there could be no compromise on extending slavery. "If there is," he said, "then all our hard work is lost. If trouble comes, it is better to let it come now than at some later time."
The trouble would come soon. One by one, the states of the South seceded. By February 1st, 1861, six states had followed South Carolina out of the Union. A few days later, representatives from the states met in Montgomery, Alabama. Their job was to create a new nation. It would be an independent republic called the Confederate States of America. The convention approved a constitution for the new nation. The document was like the Constitution of the United States, but with major changes. The Southern Constitution gave greater importance to the rights of states, and it said there could be no laws against slavery. The convention named former United States Senator Jefferson Davis to be president of the Confederate States of America. Davis did not want civil war, but he was not afraid of it. He said, "Our separation from the old Union is complete. The time for compromise has passed. Should others try to change our decision with force, they will smell Southern gunpowder and feel the steel of Southern swords."
Jefferson Davis left his farm in Mississippi to become president of the Confederate States of America on February 11th. On that same day, Abraham Lincoln left his home in Illinois to become president of the United States. As Lincoln got on the train that would take him to Washington, he said, "I now leave, not knowing when or whether ever I may return. The task before me is greater than that which rested upon our first president. Without the help of God, I cannot succeed. With that assistance, I cannot fail. Let us hope that all yet will be well."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.